It's been 16 years since 12-year-old Jalique Rainwalker vanished. His disappearance from rural upstate New York was ruled a probable child homicide. But no one has ever been charged, and his body has never been found. I'm Jessica Marshall.
And I'm Wendy Liberatore.
In this podcast from the Times Union, we'll take a deep dive into this mystery, the case of a missing child that has unsettled New York's Capital Region and beyond for more than a decade. Did he run away? Was he murdered? We will try to shed some more light on what happened to Jalique. This is Rainwalker, the Lost Boy.
Episode 9, Stranger Danger.
Before we begin, a word of caution. The story we are about to tell involves situations that may be very disturbing to some listeners. So please take care as you listen. When we started this podcast, Jalique Rainwalker had been missing for a decade and a half. A year later, there are still no answers to the ultimate question. What happened to the 12-year-old boy on the night of November 1st, 2007? In our first 7 episodes, we tried to shake something loose. We went over the details of the case. We retraced what we knew of Jalique's steps on that fateful night. We took you back to the small town of Greenwich, New York, where he was allegedly last seen.
It's Greenwich, not Greenwich. Say it phonetically.
We talked to the people who knew him, who loved him.
He's a child. He's my grandchild.
I mean, we spent a year of our lives looking for him and trying to find out what happened to him.
We talked to some of the last people to see him alive. Some of them told us their stories for the first time ever publicly.
You know, it's like, hi, my name's Katie. I was the last person to see a missing child. It's not that, but I've never talked with most anyone about this.
We talked to the investigators who worked on the case. Investigators who ultimately determined that Jalique had not in fact just disappeared. They believe he'd been murdered. We were hoping that we could return to this podcast series with some major developments in the investigation into Jalique Rainwalker's disappearance. Hoping that we could finally say, this is what happened to him, and this is who is responsible. But that is sadly not the case. We are here now with a new episode because of another child who went missing. On an unusually warm Saturday night on the last day of September 2023, a 9-year-old girl vanished from a New York State Park campground. She was riding her bicycle around a short camping loop with other children at Moreau Lake State Park. That is in Saratoga County, which coincidentally is just about 20 miles from where Jalique went missing nearly 16 years earlier. The kids that this 9-year-old was with called it quits on the biking around 6 p.m. But this girl, whom we are not naming to protect her privacy, wanted to do one more go-round by herself. Her parents said yes. They didn't have much reason to worry. It was a small campground, and they were friendly with the other campers. So the girl took off on her bike. 10 minutes later, she hadn't returned. This worried her parents, so they went looking for her. They found her bike abandoned a short way around the loop. There was no trace of their daughter. Frantic, they searched the campground, screaming and shouting her name. Friends and fellow campers joined in to help. But she was gone. Her parents called 911. Within an hour, in the near pitch black of night, the park was crawling with state police and searchers. It became quickly clear. This was an abduction. The next morning, around 10 a.m., that's 14 hours after she was reported missing, police issued an Amber Alert. Within a day, the FBI was involved. So was New York Governor Kathy Hochul.
A command post has been established at the state park right behind us. And additional search teams were deployed this morning. Right now, there's over 100 personnel deployed and 75 law enforcement on the ground, the two drones, an airboat, search team, six underwater rescue teams, another boat that has sonar.
The story blew up. The little girl's name and face were plastered on social media, across front pages and television screens.
We are leaving no stone, no branch, no table, no cabin, unturned, untouched, unexamined, in our search to find.
People all over the nation were holding their breath. The unthinkable had happened. An innocent little girl was abducted by a stranger. It tapped into every parent or guardian's worst nightmare. Where was this little girl? Who took her? What was happening to her? And would they ever find her?
Every parent's worst nightmare. We are asking for your help. We desperately need your help. A 9-year-old little girl out on a camping trip with her family goes for one more loop around the campground with her bike, and now she's missing.
The little girl's aunt went on Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on Fox Nation 2 days after she went missing.
Blonde with bangs, green eyes, 4'7", 90 pounds. Third grade, right, Janae?
Fourth grade.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
Locally, you couldn't ignore it. The girl's face was everywhere. And it seemed like almost everyone in the capital region had a connection to her of some kind, like her parents were friends with a friend, or the kid of someone you know went to school or camp with her. People were hurting over her disappearance, writing about it on Facebook, and hugging their children a little tighter every hour that she was missing. Meanwhile, hundreds of law enforcement officials, from state police and the local sheriffs to the FBI, scoured the area in and around the park by land, water, and air. Police helicopters soared overhead, bloodhounds obsessively sniffed the campgrounds and woods, and boats scoured Moreau Lake. The 48-hour mark was nearing.
We all know the stories. The first 24 hours, there's hope. But when you hit 48 hours, hope starts to wane.
But in the wee hours of Monday morning, there was a development. Police stationed outside the girl's home found a note in the mailbox around 4 a.m. According to police, there had been a steady stream of well-wishers stopping by the house to drop off food and cards for the family, who at the time were refusing to leave the campground until their daughter was found. State police say a truck pulled up to the house around 4:20. The driver left a note in the mailbox. When they recovered it after the truck left, they discovered it was a ransom note asking for $50,000. Hours later, law enforcement were able to extract a single fingerprint from that note. And that print led them to a man named Craig Nelson Ross Jr., a 46-year-old from nearby Milton, He had no criminal history, save an arrest for driving while intoxicated 25 years ago. Police apprehended Ross at his family's mobile home property in Milton about 4 hours later.
They found a double-wide house with a woman, the suspect's mother. The suspect lived in the camper behind. They have what they call a dynamic entry, a tactical maneuver, and within the camper they located the suspect. After some resistance, the suspect was taken into custody, and immediately the little girl was found in a cabinet, cupboard. She was rescued.
They found her, alive. Craig Nelson Ross Jr. was charged with the kidnapping on October 3rd. On November 17th, a grand jury indicted him on 9 charges, including rape and kidnapping. He pleaded not guilty. The top count of first-degree kidnapping alone carries a maximum sentence of 25 years to life. And the Times Union reported that Ross is also now facing scrutiny for possible involvement in the murders of 2 teenagers in 2003 and 2005. These girls had both disappeared near Ross's family property in Milton. Their remains were also later found nearby. Law enforcement says they believe the girls' cases are connected to each other, but they will neither confirm nor deny at this point that Ross had any involvement in either. After the little girl was found in October, her family released a statement. Quote, "We are thrilled that she is home, and we understand that the outcome is not what every family gets. A huge thank you to the FBI, the New York State Police, all of the agencies that were mobilized, all of the families, friends, community, neighbors, and hundreds of volunteers who supported us and worked tirelessly to bring home." End quote. Wendy and I were just as gripped as anyone watching this 48-hour search. We wanted to see this little girl found safely as much as anybody. But given what we just went through making this podcast, we had to sit down and talk about it.
You know, when we saw the abduction of the 9-year-old girl, you know, you and I kind of, it struck a nerve for us maybe a little differently than most other folks who had not been immersed in the story of Jalique Rainwalker for as long as we had and as intensely as we had. I mean, we kind of could not ignore some of the differences in the response, I think, to her going missing and Jalique going missing. So how did that make you feel?
As soon as I saw the news about the 9-year-old girl that went missing up at Moreau Lake, I immediately, in my mind, jumped to Jalique.
Me too.
This is the same, a disappearance of a child. Of course, what was different was the response.
Right.
The police were all over it instantaneously, which did not happen for Jalique, which makes me believe is part of the reason Jalique is still missing.
Right. And we don't know essentially anything about what happened to him beyond what the police have made public, which is next to nothing.
Exactly.
No one looked for him for 48 hours. I mean, George Bell admitted that. But the state police also told us that, you know, if they had started looking for him sooner, things might have turned out differently. I mean, you know, they can't say for sure, but it's harder. You know, they lost a lot of lead time. That was right. actually admitted. There were no, but also there were no, you know, there's nothing like search helicopters. Nancy Grace didn't get involved. There was no Amber Alert, you know, none right. of the things that were kind of kicked into gear for this 9-year-old girl within that 48-hour period were even considered for Jalik. He was considered a runaway at first.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what happened.
I want to be careful here in how we talk about it, in that we're not talking about whether or not the parents appeared distraught enough about their child going missing, because, you know, how a parent in that situation is going to show emotion publicly is kind of not a measure of anything. Yeah, but what we are talking about is kind of what they told police when they first reported their children missing. Both families did. They called, you know, local investigators to report their kids missing. Jalik's adoptive parents told the police that they thought he ran away, whereas the little girl's parents,
they were absolutely clear that, you know, something bad happened to her.
Right.
And yes, in the case of Jalik, they said he ran away.
Right.
And I think if the response from the parents was different, there would have been a different response from the police.
Right. And one of the things that we, a number of things that we learned from Barbara Reilly and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children was that, and also the Black and Missing Foundation, was that the families of the missing, in many ways, it's kind of incumbent upon them to continue to press law enforcement as well if they want their children found, because these things are messy and complicated and, you know, law enforcement only has so many resources and all that. So sort of keeping the case of a missing child alive falls a lot on the families. And if the families aren't doing what they need to do or aren't, you know, doing the best practices that the Black and Missing Foundation and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children are advising, you know, the kids can fall through the cracks.
Absolutely. The parents of Jalik asked Barbara to stop looking for Jalik. And when she didn't, that's when the break in the family came.
As Barbara told us in episode 5.
Mm-hmm. And I would have to say, too, that the response from police after the 48 hours was massive, you know, with searches and helicopters and divers, but it was too late. And Jalik was long gone.
16 years later, he's still long gone with very little clues. One of the other things that I wanted to touch on, you know, with regard to the differences between the cases, you know, it was 2007 versus 2023, right? Social yes. media, like, wasn't quite what it is. It was in its infancy, really. Like, Facebook was, at that point in 2007, still, like, mostly just college students. Twitter was just born. Instagram didn't even exist yet. You know, you and I both saw on Facebook in particular, people were just sharing images of this child, all of her details. Like, people were just, you know, the emotions were so high. Everybody wanted to find her. That really wasn't possible back in 2007.
No, there was no way to share all the information. All we had was, you know, news reports. Okay. And the news reports did not start happening until the Monday after he went missing.
Right.
So it took a while.
There's technological factors at play here, too. It wasn't just that, you know, I mean, it's not any one, you can't point to any one thing at this point. It's just kind of a whole perfect storm of factors that.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. And there's one more that we can't really ignore. And that's a very large systemic issue. We talked about this in episode 5 with Natalie Wilson of the Black and Missing Foundation about, you know, the fact that missing white kids receive a disproportionately larger amount of media attention and law enforcement attention than missing kids of color.
Women of color, too.
Yes, exactly. And this is from pretty alarming statistics. And, you know, in this case, Jalik was half Black. He was Black. He was a child of color. And the little girl that went missing here just, you know, a little while ago was a little white girl. You can't ignore that. What else can we say about how this kind of made us feel? And
well, it certainly made me feel sad. It was like a punch in the gut, because every time I hear of a missing child,
right,
I first of all fear for them. worry about their parents because I know they must be going through hell.
Let's go back for a minute to episode 5 of Rainwalker, The Lost Boy. When we produced it, we only had access to the 2021 statistics on missing persons in the United States from the National Crime Information Center. Now, the 2022 stats have since been released, but sadly, there's no improvement on the stats for missing children of color. Of the missing children reported during 2022, that's those 17 and under, 39% of them were Black. According to the 2020 census data, only 13.6% of the American population is Black, so those numbers are pretty staggering. Natalie Wilson, co-founder of the Black and Missing Foundation, says only 7% of missing persons of color of any age gets any sort of national media attention.
And, you know, we can all name the Gabby Petitos, the Natalie Holloway, the Chandra Levies, and many more. But can any of your listeners name a person of color that has garnered the same level of national media coverage? They can't, and guess why? Because it doesn't happen. So we want our missing to be household names too.
There are many complicating factors that make directly comparing Jalique's case with that of the little girl pretty difficult. But one thing they do have in common is something that we wanted to probe further here. What happens in the United States when a child goes missing? Usually their parent, guardian, or other concerned citizen will alert law enforcement. That's the recommended course of action. Law enforcement will investigate the situation, and if there's a reason to believe the child has been abducted based on guidelines from the U.S. Department of Justice, they'll launch an Amber Alert. Here's New York State Police Senior Investigator Erica Hawk on how that works in New York.
The New York State Amber Alert plan can be activated when an investigating law enforcement agency has reasonable cause to believe that an abduction of a child under the age of 18 has occurred and the child is believed to be in danger of serious bodily harm or death, either due to the actions of another or due to a proven mental or physical condition.
The term AMBER stands for America's Missing Broadcast Emergency Response. The AMBER Alert system was created in 1996. The state of New York adopted the system in 2002. Now, AMBER is the aforementioned acronym, but it was also named after another 9-year-old girl who went missing while riding her bicycle. Her name was Amber Hagerman. Her story does not have a happy ending. Amber Hagerman disappeared in Arlington, Texas in January of 1996. She was abducted by a stranger in the parking lot of an abandoned grocery store. Her body was found 4 days later in a creek several miles away. She'd been brutally murdered, but her kidnapper and killer has never been found. Today, in 2023, the U.S. Justice Department says that 1,127 children have been saved thanks to the Amber Alert system. Before Amber Alerts, there were milk carton kids. In the 1980s, police worked with dairy producers to print the images and biographical details of missing American kids on their milk cartons. The idea was that the information would be disseminated to homes far and wide, and who could ignore that kid's face when it was right in front of them while they're eating their cereal each morning? The first milk carton kid was Eitan Pates, a 6-year-old who went missing in New York City in 1979 while waiting for his school bus.
At 7:55 last Friday morning, Julie Pat says she took her son downstairs. She came back up and watched from this fire escape as he passed down West Broadway toward the bus stop, where a group of other children and parents were waiting. She never dreamed he didn't get on that bus, not until 4 o'clock in the afternoon when he failed to return home.
The concept of the milk carton kids fell out of favor when the Amber Alert system came into play, but it's firmly ingrained in pop culture. It gave rise to the term stranger danger.
Hi there. Do you live around here?
Uh-huh.
You going to school?
Yes.
Well, I could give you a ride.
Last year, 50,000 children disappeared. Many of them...
That's Jenny. But that's not Jenny's dad. If she gets into that car, you may be looking at Jenny for the last time. I'm McGruff, the crime dog.
Not all missing kids are the same. There are different reasons they've gone missing. There were many theories floated about what happened to Jalik. Many of them were floated by his own adoptive father to police. He joined a gang. He went to be, quote, with his people in Albany, Schenectady, or Troy. An anonymous letter sent to media 4 months after his disappearance said he was taken to, quote, become a foot soldier in this war on drugs, whatever that means. Law enforcement believes he was murdered. But by whom? They've never named a killer, whether it was a stranger or not. And they never said he was kidnapped. Given what happened recently to the 9-year-old girl in Saratoga County and what we know about Jalik's disappearance, we started thinking it was important to understand the reasons why kids go missing in America. For that, we turned to David Finkelhor. He is a sociology professor and the director of the Crimes Against Children Research Center at the University of New Hampshire. He's been studying cases of missing children for decades. We jumped on a Zoom call soon after the 9-year-old girl had been found safe in Saratoga County.
Missing children is a catch-all category that includes several very, very different kinds of situations.
Finkelhor sorts the situations into several subcategories. The first, and largest by far, are kids who leave their households because of a family conflict. They're often called runaways or throwaways. After the runaways come family abductions. That's most often kids who get taken illegally by a parent or guardian during the course of a custody dispute. After that comes kids who go missing by accident. Those can be something as innocent as a miscommunication with mom or dad. Maybe they forgot they had to be somewhere at some time. Or they could be as serious as a kid wandering off into the woods by themselves and falling into water and drowning, or something similarly horrifying. The good news, though, Finkelhor says, is that most of the three aforementioned subcategories of missing children are resolved. The child is found and returned to their rightful guardian, though happy ending is not always the right way to describe it.
Whether there's a happy ending, though, is not clear, because in a lot of these instances, like the runaways, thrownaways, and the custody disputes issues, the problems and the conflicts aren't really resolved, and they often are present to create the possibility for additional missingness at future times.
But then there's one last category. It's by far the least common, but most feared type of missing child. The stranger abduction. A kid gets snatched up off their bicycle in a state park campground or at a grocery store parking lot. It's the universal fuel of parental nightmares.
Stranger abduction scenarios are relatively uncommon, a few dozen every year in the United States. They occur under a variety of circumstances. They involve more teenagers than younger kids. They involve more girls than boys. Sexual assault is the biggest motivator. I already think there is a considerable overestimation of the frequency with which that kind of crime occurs.
Yet, nonetheless, stranger danger is ever present in American society. We teach our kids about stranger danger. Don't talk to strangers. They learn about it at school, too. But if stranger abductions are rare, why are we always on such high alert for them?
Well, I think there are two big historical periods of increased anxiety. One was in the 20s and 30s. There were some major abductions like the Lindbergh kidnapping, particularly where there was ransom involved.
A quick recap for those unfamiliar. Charles Lindbergh was a superstar aviator, the first to fly across the Atlantic. His 20-month-old son was kidnapped from his nursery at their house near Hopewell, New Jersey in 1932. The kidnapping was accompanied by several ransom notes. 10 weeks later, the child's body was found in the woods nearby. The media called it the crime of the century. 3 years later, a German immigrant named Bruno Richard Hauptmann was convicted and sentenced to death for the kidnapping and murder. He was executed in 1936.
Those kinds of episodes have disappeared, I think largely because of policing has gotten very good and the ability to recover children has improved, and the likelihood that you can get away with a ransom note and collect money has become more difficult.
The next period of hysteria over stranger abductions came in the 1980s, and that was with the kidnapping and murder of 6-year-old Adam Walsh. Adam's dad, John Walsh, went on to produce and host the hit television show America's Most Wanted, which helped law enforcement solve cases. According to the Pew Research Center's 2023 data on parenting in America, kidnapping and abduction is number 3 on the list of top parental concerns. Parents and guardians, though, Finkelhorst says, do have other reasons to worry about crimes against their children. Maybe just not always the situations they fear most.
Children are the most criminally victimized segment of the population. They have risks of assault, rape, robbery that are 2 to 3 times higher than the adult population in general.
Finkelhorst says parents and guardians should be most concerned for their children about violence in their own household, bullying at school or outside of the home, and sexual abuse by people they know and trust within their communities. We'll be right back.
If you're enjoying this podcast, take advantage of all the Times Union has to offer and support our efforts to bring you award-winning journalism by becoming a Times Union subscriber today. Go to timesunion.com/subscribe.
Welcome back. You're listening to Rainwalker, The Lost Boy. We recently had a chance to talk to Janae Senna. Her niece was the 9-year-old girl whose story we've told in this episode. Senna says the family has some thoughts and questions about the way the investigation into her niece's abduction has been handled.
A lot of the questions I get asked the same questions over and over again about her and her case and stuff like that. And, you know, a lot of people ask me, why did it take so long for the Amber Alert to go out when they essentially knew she was taken? Because the bloodhounds were on the scene very early on and her scent stopped. So you kind of have to know she was put in a car and taken. So why wasn't the Amber Alert sent out then? And it's because there's a protocol that the Amber Alert follows.
The New York State Police would only provide a voiced statement on how they handle Amber Alerts generally. They declined to speak about the specifics of the case of the abducted girl. Here again is senior investigator Erica Hawk.
Even if formal activation criteria has been met, activation may be impractical If information is not specific enough and or an extended period of time has passed since the disappearance. Reasonable cause to believe means that from eyewitness accounts or by eliminating other possibilities that the investigation leads to the belief that the child has been abducted. Additional resources are often utilized based on each circumstance and the case details.
Senna and her family say they understand a protocol was followed for the Amber Alert.
There is a lot of questions like, should that protocol be changed? Should there be, you know, different scenarios added to it? You know, people ask me all the time, why did it take so long? And I'm like, I don't know. I just know there's a protocol and it was followed, you know, and that those are those detrimental, like, first hours in that type of situation.
Senna says their family wants to share their experience and questions that came up during the investigation to help victims and their families in the future. They're making outreach to state and federal lawmakers. Senna says they want to know why a victim, particularly a child, should be forced to tell their story to multiple people multiple times during an investigation. And why, she says, does the media insist on blasting the exact nature of the sexual assault charges against her alleged abductor across front pages and television screens?
I mean, everybody's doing okay, you know? It's one day at a time. That's really the best way I can describe it. It's just about us moving forward, focusing on her moving forward and having the normal childhood and the normal life that she should have. We're really focused now on just making sure that justice gets served, really just taking it one day at a time.
As we've mentioned throughout this series, police have not revealed much publicly about what they think happened to Jalik, beyond that they believe he was murdered. We don't have any answers to that question of what happened to Jalik. We don't have any new clues or information. But for the group of people who still look out for him, that includes his grandmother, Barbara Reilly, and a 5,000-member Facebook group called Justice for Jalik Rainwalker, there has been something new. Remember Jessica Von Guinness and Kevin Brock from Episode 2? They are two of the founders of that Facebook group. On a hot, sunny day over the summer, we met Jessica and Kevin in Gannon Park in Greenwich. They had something they wanted to show us.
It's so good to see you.
Yeah, wonderful to see you. Yeah, seriously, may I hug you?
Yes.
Hello.
Oh, no,
what a pleasure. Hi, hello. Jessica. Hi, can I hug you?
It's beautiful. It's so much bigger than I was picturing.
Me too. I knew when we ordered it, I just said, whatever the biggest one is, you know, the most solid, like, let's just go for it.
So. Jessica Von Guinness is gesturing at a bench in the corner of the park near the entrance. It's about 8 feet long, made of curved black steel that looks remarkably ergonomic. It's also remarkably comfortable to sit in for a steel bench. When I sat down, I had a full view of the idyllic little park.
Yeah, right?
Gannon Park is named after Kim Gannon. Remember from Episode 2, the guy who wrote, "I'll be home for Christmas"? It's a quaint little spot a few blocks from the center of town, across the street from the Greenwich Central School. It has a sandlot baseball field on one side, a small playground on the far end, and a round concrete splash pad in the center. The pad was fully operational when we got there. About a half dozen kids were splashing joyfully in the summer heat. In the center of the bench backrest is a small plaque It's black with gold mat and gold lettering. It reads very clearly, "In memory of Jalique Boyd Rainwalker, never forgotten, always loved."
Too, for a little baby who has been missing now almost 16 years, the victim of a probable child homicide, for a child to not have a place of remembrance, a gravesite, a memorial, a ceremony, that just doesn't sit right for me in my gut.
Von Guinness, along with Kevin Brock and other members of the Justice for Jalique Rainwalker Facebook group, started a GoFundMe and raised more than $2,000 over the spring to buy the bench. The town of Greenwich installed it in June.
You know, we can only do so much as a group, but lifting Jalique up is our intention. Keeping his name loud, keeping his name in the forefront.
Kevin Brock thinks the bench's permanent presence could help the case move forward.
I just wanted to bring up that bench could also be helpful for answers, you know, like someone local that knows something, they see that bench, they see that name, Jalique Rainwalker, on there, they'll be like, should I say something or what, you know?
It
might motivate them to, embolden them to come forward.
There are people out there. There's somebody out there that holds information, and even if it's not the person of interest, that person might think, oh, this stuff I know, it's not going to help, but really, really it does. Every little piece of information, every thought, every memory matters, especially for Jalique. Every memory.
So that's where Jalique's story stands right now. There are still no suspects in his probable homicide. His body has never been found. But for thousands of people, hope is still alive that the truth will eventually come out. If you have information on the disappearance of Jalique Rainwalker, the New York State Police are urging you to call 518-692-9332. Again, that's 518-692-9332. You can also email tips to nysvicap@troopers.ny.gov. We'd also love to hear from our listeners. What questions do you have for us? What angles do you think we should explore about this case in future episodes? Email us at podcast@timesunion.com. If you have reason to believe that your child or a child you know has been abducted, call your local police department. After you've reported the child missing to law enforcement, you can also call the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children at 1-800-843-5678. You can also contact the Black and Missing Foundation at www.blackandmissinginc.com/report. Rainwalker, the Lost Boy, is a Times Union podcast. This series was produced and edited by Wendy Libertor and myself, Jessica Marshall. We had help from Lauren Stanforth, Susan Mahalik, Lori Todd, Erica Smith, Tom Crocker, and Casey Seiler. Special thanks to Christy Gustafson-Barletti. Our theme song is As You Make the Bed by Amos Noah. Additional music by ELFL, American Legion, Sleepaway Camp, and Roots in Recognition.